Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Deborah Becker. In for Robin Young, it's Here and Now. President Obama is promising to speed up delivery of federal stimulus money this summer, which he says will create or save 600,000 jobs. But what has the $787 billion stimulus package done so far? Some states are complaining that very little has trickled down to them, and some analysts say that too many stimulus dollars are going to plug state budget holes and not to things that would directly help jumpstart the economy. A recent analysis by USA Today showed that Idaho has received the most stimulus money so far, more than $245 per person in that state, while Florida, despite its massive foreclosure crisis, is receiving $1.84 per person. We've invited two mayors from both of those states to speak with us about this. First, David Beter, mayor of Boise, Idaho. And Mayor Beter, how much money have you received so far in federal stimulus dollars?
Well, we're just around $60 million. Some of it is still working its way to us, but that has been approved, and a fair amount of that is already out in the economy working for us.
Mm-hmm. So. And what's it working on?
Well, that's what I guess I've been the most pleased with, is how practical it's turned out to be in several instances. For instance, I think one of the best pieces is the energy efficiency block grant funding. We qualify for around $2 million of it. We have a project to retrofit city historic streetlights that will save a good deal on our power bill. Two local companies have submitted a low bid. So it's a great example of how we can put it to work. One of the companies is a startup company that's helped develop an LED retrofit technology, as well as a solar-powered streetlight. That's been one of the best examples we've had. Also, we actually have a highway district that maintains the street even in our city, but we got about $4 million in dollars to put to overlays on the streets, and that has also gone out quite quickly, and we're starting to see the effects of that.
Mm-hmm. $4 million on overlays on the streets. What does that mean?
It just means basically redoing your streets.
I see.
That's a fair amount of workers involved, and it's those are the kind of things that you can get out there right away, but that amount of money is, we're used to talking about 500,000, maybe a million in a year. To get 4 million was quite a big jump for us.
Mm-hmm. So when we read about a lot of the numbers that suggest that most of the federal stimulus money that has gone to cities and states is actually being used for things like fixing budget holes and paying for health care and unemployment benefits, in your particular case, it sounds like the bulk of this is actually being used for some of the highway projects that we heard it was going to be used for to begin with.
Well, we've been pleased that way. It's been very practical, so far for us. I do need to, in your intro, talking about the amount per person in Idaho, I think, although that may be technically true, we have a national lab. They do a lot of nuclear research and experimentation there. That money went out the quickest and the most around the country, I understand. So I think the overall per person number is skewed because of that effect.
Mm-hmm. And you would say then that, for at least in your case, the stimulus money is creating jobs and is going towards shovel-ready highway projects for the most part.
Yeah, we've been real pleased with the practical effects. I would say that, I think we've worked really hard to get ready for it, but we also, I think, for better or worse, went in with fairly low expectations at the speed and progress of this. My anticipation was that a lot of it would be spent at the state level and not at the city level. So my expectations were fairly low, for better or worse. But more of it than I expected has come right to the city.
And come right to you from the state, or come right to you from the feds?
From the feds.
Mm-hmm. Now, your unemployment rate is right about at the national level. It's about 9%, if I understand it correctly.
Well, that's our whole metropolitan area. Mm-hmm. Ours is quite a bit lower in the city of Boise.
Definitely then not one of the areas hit hardest by this economic downturn.
No, I don't think so. Not on the magnitude of Arizona, California, some of the other states.
Mm-hmm. So why do you think then that your state has seemed to fare so much better than some of the other states who may have been even harder hit by the recession?
Well, I think in some of those instances, because they were harder hit, the type of stimulus they're maybe expecting or applying for is a little more difficult to get out quite as quickly.
Now, you said you got to work fairly early on trying to figure out what you would do if stimulus dollars came your way. Some states have actually appointed or hired folks to wade through the paperwork and the whole process to try to get money more quickly. Did you do something like that in Boise?
We didn't. We do have a lobbyist at the federal level that alerted us about the possibilities. They ended up being pretty accurate about where a lot of the funding would go, and we could get a running start at it.
Do you expect you'll receive more federal stimulus money?
Well, we're hopeful on a couple more. There's in particular, the COPS grants for our police department. I know that there's a lot of departments, actively seeking those funds, but we are hopeful about. We also have a transportation project for a streetcar here in the city of Boise.
How much would you want for that?
Well, there's a couple different approaches, but maybe 20 to 25 million. That would be a big, quite a good project. And in the COP grants as well could go a long way. Like everybody, we haven't had to lay off any police officers, but we have had to hold hiring new ones, and those COPS grants would allow us to move forward on some hiring that we could use.
Mm-hmm. Have you had to lay off any other workers? Are there any other signs in Boise of the economic downturn right now?
We did. We have about 1,600 workers. We ended up laying off 9. We have had some pretty tough layoffs in the city and in the area. Micron Technology is one of our biggest companies. They laid off a couple thousand workers a little over a year ago. So we've definitely felt it. We have a pretty vibrant startup business community, some vibrancy in entrepreneurship, and some other tech companies especially have been hiring in this time. So there is a decent counter to those layoffs, but certainly we've felt it like the rest of the country.
Yeah. Any estimates at all then in terms of a rough number of jobs that may have been created because of federal stimulus dollars?
Well, I would definitely say it's in the hundreds. It'd be hard for me to get too much more specific than that.
Okay. David Beter, mayor of Boise, Idaho, thanks very much.
You're welcome. I appreciate it.
We turn now to Jim Birch. He's the mayor of Cape Coral, Florida, which is next to Fort Myers on the southwest coast. Cape Coral is about the same as Boise in terms of population and median income, but Cape Coral has been hit harder than Boise by the economic downturn. And Mayor Birch, we spoke with you back in February when you were optimistic you would be getting stimulus money quickly. You've called your community ground zero of the boom and bust. Sketch out what you're grappling with.
We currently are at about a 12% unemployment. Foreclosures have come down, but just to give you an idea, I think we've been on the average somewhere over 2,000 foreclosures per month over the last 2 years, and now we're down under 1,800. So we are, if for us, we're seeing that as a very positive sign. 2 years ago, our median home price was $322,000, and today, as we speak, it's $85,000. Our budget, for our general fund budget, of course, the property taxes are tied to that. So in 2 years, we've lost 50% of our revenue. And, of course, we're in the budget talks now to try and determine how we maintain our services with, less than half of the revenue that we've generated under in the past 2 years. This is a city that's been very vibrant for many, many years and will become vibrant once again. And we just, we're looking for a little help in the interim there, and unfortunately at this point we don't feel like we have realized that yet.
So how much federal stimulus money or federal help have you gotten so far?
Well, we got a $1.4 million block grant for the energy block grant. That would be similar to the energy grant that the mayor from Boise said. And then other than that, we've got the National Stabilization Program, which is the acronym would be NSP. We received $7 million from that program, which is a good, a good chunk of money. What it does is it allows us to buy up abandoned properties. It also allows us to repair certain things and try and put some of these things back out to people that, lower income people, to try and put some of these properties back in the hands of residents as opposed to sitting there abandoned. But it's really, as much as we appreciate that funding, it's a very small amount on the scale of the in proportion that we have here. We were certainly very, very much encouraged that we might get money for all of our utility projects, because we You know, we do have 400 miles of canals. We're a very environmentally sensitive area, and you know, we are trying to move away from well and septic, which we've done in half of our city, and we had to stop that program because of the funding issues. And as a result of that, you know, we had about $300 million worth of shovel-ready projects that we could start tomorrow.
So when you hear the mayor of Boise, Idaho, saying that he's gotten about $60 million in federal stimulus money, what are you thinking? Why do you think that there is that discrepancy?
Well, you know, I'm not really certain. I couldn't speculate as to why. And, you know, when I was at the U.S. Mayor's Conference in January, my purpose in going up there, my primary purpose was to get the message out that when we're discussing how this money is going to come down from the federal government, let's make sure that the criteria of foreclosure rates and unemployment are at the very top of the list as to how the criteria for distribution and allocation of this funding, because that clearly would demonstrate the economic distressed areas. I think Representative Frank, you know, certainly heard me, and I think he changed some of his legislation to try and see it happen. But somewhere along the way, when the money started flowing down, it did not come directly to our city, that's for certain, and it ended up being diverted into the state. The state did use you know, a fair amount of money to try and balance their books. They did distribute a lot of money, but the money was done on different criteria. Consequently, I think that's the reason why we didn't receive some of that. So we're seeing a different sense of how things operated. You know, the mayor of Boise is seeing something coming directly to him. It certainly did not happen in the state of Florida.
Do you think also that perhaps some of it the state is using because it's allowed to use it now to balance its budget, and because of the state budget crisis, the state finds itself having to use the federal stimulus money for really immediate budget concerns?
Yeah, I do, and I'm not going to, you know, to throw stones beyond that, because the state of Florida is suffering the same malaise that we are. I mean, you know, the entire state has experienced a downturn in the property values, and of course, we are a state that relies, in my opinion, far too heavily on it. And I think Tallahassee needs to fix that. My concern would be this: is that, you know, yes, if you take conventional wisdom, if they don't use that money, then they may pass that down to the local governments. But the problem is, when you use that money, that's a one-time deal for them. And so it's a one-time shot, and there is no resolution of what's going to happen next year. So, in other words, it's very easy for them to take that money, put it in and balance their books. But what's going to happen next year when they have to do the same thing? Because our values next year, we're going to suffer the same problem.
But just briefly, Jim, do you think that you'll be able to break this logjam soon and get some federal stimulus dollars?
You know, I wish I could tell you that I do believe that, and I certainly am going to continue to try, but I haven't seen any signs of encouragement. And so I can't tell you that I will. I am optimistic that I will not quit trying until somebody tells me the last dollar is gone.
All right. Jim Birch, mayor of Cape Coral, Florida. Jim, good luck.
Okay, I appreciate that.
Just ahead, how will the White House respond to North Korea sentencing two American journalists to 12 years of hard labor? And later in the show, Jack Kerouac's intricate fantasy sports world. Back in a minute, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. Former U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Bill Richardson, says North Korea is playing a high-stakes poker game. Richardson was commenting on today's announcement that Pyongyang sentenced two American journalists to 12 years of hard labor. The journalists, Laura Lang and Yuna Lee, work for Al Gore's television venture, Current TV. They were accused of illegally entering North Korea. The Obama administration has been considering inspecting North Korean ships after the country's latest round of nuclear and missile tests. David Sanger is New York Times chief Washington correspondent. And David, first of all, what's expected to happen to these journalists?
In this case, I think the American hope is that having pronounced the sentence of 12 years of hard labor, that Kim Jong-il, the country's dictator, will just throw these two young ladies out of the country. The problem that we run into here, as with all things with North Korea now, is that there is clearly a succession struggle underway. Last week, Mr. Kim announced that his younger son, Kim Jong-un would be his designated successor, but we think there are many who don't want that to take place. When you have succession struggles underway, appearing weak in front of the Americans, giving in to an American demand, may not be the path that many in North Korea choose.
So you think that really what's happening here is it's sort of an image thing on the part of North Korea, more than North Korea potentially using these women as a bargaining chip with the U.S. over its nuclear program?
You know, they might try to, but I can't imagine that would be very successful. I mean, let's face it, we've had nearly two decades of wrangling with North Korea over its nuclear program. They just conducted 2 weeks ago today a second nuclear test. The concern in the U.S. government now is that they could move from a rudimentary nuclear capability to one in which they actually design warheads that could fit atop missiles and be launched at somebody, or that they do that so that they can advertise these weapons for sale. Of course, the North Koreans have never developed a weapon they haven't ultimately sold.
Hmm.
So that is such an overwhelming problem that I can't imagine that the Obama administration could back off on, say, the discussion over sanctions at the UN simply because the North Koreans have seized two American journalists.
So what sort of steps do you think the U.S. might take here?
Well, I think that you could well see an envoy go. You mentioned Bill Richardson at the beginning. He's been to North Korea before. Al Gore runs the news organization that these young women were working for. I wouldn't be shocked if you saw him attempt to go. But at the same time, it's going to be made more difficult by the fact that this is the critical week in getting this UN resolution with heightened sanctions together. The North Koreans are threatening another missile test. So you're into a real week or two of brinksmanship, and maybe longer.
The White House is calling on China to try to help stop North Korean ships. Do you think that's likely to happen?
Well, there are two ways to interdict shipments. The easier way is to wait for those North Korean ships to go into a port and then let a country use its own national laws to inspect the ships. Maybe not on the pretense that they're looking for weapons, but, you know, there are all kinds of customs inspections. You know, you could be saying that they need to check the fruit for fruit flies. You know, there are all kinds of things you can go do. The trick is persuading the Chinese, who are getting a little bit tired of the antics of their ally here, to go in and actually begin to crack down. The harder way to go about this, but the one that the United States and its allies may be driven to eventually, is to stop North Korean ships on the open seas under a UN resolution, board them, and inspect them. But, of course, the North Koreans have said that would be an act of war, and you could easily imagine, you know, a firefight coming out of that then escalates.
Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has said that the U.S. needs to take strong action here. She has suggested maybe putting North Korea back on the list of state-sponsored terrorist countries. What do you think of those statements from the Secretary of State?
The State Department would have to make a case that North Korea has sponsored state terrorism in recent years, and I'm not aware of any cases in which you could seriously make that claim. On the question of interceptions, the Secretary of State is trying to get all of the world, including the Chinese and the Russians, to sign on to a much tougher UN resolution, which is now being negotiated in New York. The problem is that there have been lots of UN resolutions on North Korea, and almost none of them have been enforced, including by the United States.
So what do you think negotiators are looking at this right now in terms of where the real threat is from North Korea? How would you sum it up?
You know, I've never thought, and I don't think most in the U.S. government today think, that the real threat from North Korea is that they're going to lob a, you know, nuclear missile at Japan or South Korea or U.S. troops in the region or our West Coast. First of all, we have no evidence that they can make a weapon that can fit atop a missile. But secondly, the North Koreans value survival above everything else. And so launching an attack with a return address doesn't seem like the fastest pathway to survival. The retaliation would be overwhelming. Therefore, the big risk is that they export their plutonium, their nuclear technology, Remember that reactor in Syria in 2007 that the Israelis bombed one night and then kept secret, you know, for months what it was. And as we reported and then others reported, it was, in fact, a nuclear reactor based on a North Korean design that they had exported to the Syrians, and our intel community had missed it for many years.
So it's basically selling its nuclear technology. That's the thing.
It's a proliferation threat first. It's a regional threat second. And I think what you heard Secretary Clinton refer to was if the threat is not addressed, you could imagine a change of attitude in Japan if they don't believe that our nuclear umbrella would fully cover them.
All right, David Sanger, reporter for The New York Times. His recent book is The Inheritance, The World Obama Confronts, and the Challenges to American Power. David, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Still ahead today, Jack Kerouac, before he was beat, apparently created and wrote about fantasy horse races and baseball. Back after the news, here and now. I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's here and now. As part of Chrysler and General Motors' bankruptcy restructuring, both automakers plan to close hundreds of dealerships. Chrysler is ending franchise agreements with some 800 dealers as of tomorrow. The company says it spends almost $200 million a year on marketing and administrative costs for its dealership network. Pete Lopez owns GM and Chrysler dealerships in Spencer, West Virginia. His agreement with Chrysler ends tomorrow, his Chevrolet franchise deal next year. And Pete, tell us, why are your dealerships closing?
There's no reason for it. We are a profitable dealership, and we have a senior citizen base. If they take my franchise, my dealership, my customer is going to have to drive an hour and a half for service.
So how big of a business is yours in Spencer?
Well, the mayor got on TV and said that we are 15% of the tax base. And of course, you know, anytime you're in a rural community, you try to help any way that you can. We have a what they call a Big Walnut Festival, and I'm the sponsor of that. I make sure that Roane County High School has a car for driver's ed.
Well, what about in terms of sales? How do you do in terms of sales?
Well,
do you sell quite a few cars?
Yes, I do. And by the way, when I bought this store, when I made my $1 million investment, I asked GM and Chrysler both at the same time, are you going to close this point in the future? And they said, absolutely not. We want to go back to grassroots, and we want to be Main Street America. And guess what my address is? 276 East Main Street.
So how long ago was that when you took over and asked them about this?
That was 2 years ago, and now they want to divorce me.
It was my understanding that you were supposed to be selling 100 new cars a year.
Well, they say that's one of the criteria. What they forget is when every Tuesday and every Thursday they have a Chrysler financial sale and a GM sale, and that is cars that has been in their program, and they'll have 8 to 10, 15,000 miles on them, and we purchase a truckload either every week or every other week. How can you count that is not a sale?
Are those considered used cars? Is that what the logic is there?
Right.
So in terms of the criteria for 100 new cars, you don't meet it if you look strictly at...
I sold 57 Chrysler products last year.
GM and Chrysler both say that they have to streamline in order to survive, and they say that they have to be smaller and more efficient. What do you think they should do?
Well, first of all, they are telling the public that we cost them money. My store does not cost them one penny. They say that it costs to get cars to us. Well, the consumer pays that. That is on that sticker. When you buy that car, you pay for that destination charge. There's a sign out in front of my store that's 30 years old. They put new faces up when I got here. I pay $620 a month rent on that sign. And the other one, Chrysler, is $420 a month just for the signs. And by the way, for the last 2 years since I've been here, I've never been in the red. My store is a profitable store. And the two things they look at when you buy a store is they want you to capitalize your store. That means you have to have enough money to operate your store. We've agreed to do everything that they've asked us to do, and we've made ourselves part of this community. I am the face of Chrysler and the face of GM.
How many unsold cars are in your showrooms right now?
I have 24 Chrysler products and 24 Chevrolets.
And what will happen to those?
It just depends. As of the 9th of June, I am not an official Chrysler dealer any longer. And if a dealer down in Charleston has a $3,000 rebate to give, they can do it, and I can't. But after the 9th, I can't even sell the car. It's not right. By the way, a dealer from Nebraska called me just a little while ago and said, do you know that Toyota, for the last 4 months, has been offering their dealers to go to rural areas and put in a satellite store? Can you imagine? American Cars want to close them down, and Toyota is wanting to move in.
Is that something that you're considering?
Absolutely. I have to consider something. There's two things I'll fight for, and that is my family and my livelihood. And this is my livelihood.
Well, Mr. Lopez, good luck to you.
Thank you.
That's Pete Lopez, owner of Spencer Auto Group in Spencer, West Virginia. You're listening to Here and Now. Welcome back. More than a dozen bodies, along with a large tail section from Air France Flight 447, have been found in the Atlantic Ocean, about 400 miles off the coast of Brazil. That's where the plane disappeared on May 31st with 228 people on board. Meantime, the search continues for the plane's back black box, likely at the bottom of the ocean. The French are sending a nuclear-powered submarine. The U.S. Navy is flying in two devices to try to pick up sonic pings from the black box that will begin to fade after 30 days. Our next guest says finding that black box will be like hitting a hole-in-one. Not impossible, but difficult. John Hansman is a pilot and an expert on aeronautics and astronautics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. And Professor Hansman, in the wake of the Air France crash, there are calls to move beyond the black box, but first remind us, what is a black box and what does it do?
Sure. There's actually two black boxes. One's called the cockpit voice recorder. It's essentially a digital tape recorder that's recording conversations in the cockpit, noises in the airplane, and also air traffic control communications. There's also another box called the flight data recorder. What that does is that records sensor data off the airplane, airspeed, attitude, control positions, and things like that. And that's useful to reconstruct an accident after the fact.
And in this particular case, I think that there are a lot of folks who are wondering, you know, why are we still relying on black box technology? That, you know, there are constant stories about people having difficulty locating and after an accident, and why aren't we doing something a little bit more sophisticated like a GPS system in an aircraft?
Well, the flight data recorders actually do record the GPS data, so we do have GPS. It's important to distinguish between the airplane knowing where it is, so navigation systems that tell the airplane where it is, and communication systems where the airplane can communicate back to the outside world. There are some people who are interested in automatic broadcasting of a lot of air data or aircraft parameters all the time so that you could reconstruct after the fact. There are two problems with that. First, it's just expensive. So it turns out when you're out over the ocean, it costs you about $5 a message for every message you send up through the satellite because there's not that much satellite time available. The second is that there's a huge amount of data. So who would be looking at that data? Who would be going through it and whatever? In most cases, after an accident like this, we actually do recover the black box. So you have a lot of this discussion in the few days while they're searching. So it's not clear to me that it actually makes sense from a, you know, cost-effective basis.
Can you tell me how far away can a black box be before people can still get a signal from it?
In the air, they send out a radio signal that can be heard for 50 or 100 miles. Underwater, they send out an acoustical ping, sort of essentially a sonar signal. Depending on the water temperature and things like that, that can be heard by a few miles.
Hopefully they'll be able to locate those and they'll be able to tell them something. Based on what you've read, do you have any theories?
What we know, in this particular airplane, it did have an automatic condition reporting system. So we did get messages from satellite, from the airplane, bounced off a satellite. We know the pilot actually sent an email message saying that they were going to go through a line of thunderstorms. About 10 minutes later, we started to get messages indicating that systems were failing on the airplane. It appears that the air data sensor or airspeed sensor on the airplane, at least one or two of them, had problems. A few minutes later, there was an indication of loss of electrical power and depressurization.
And in fact, French investigators say the airspeed sensors on the wings of the plane had not been replaced, as the manufacturer recommended 2 years ago. Airbus says those sensors could be vulnerable to icing up during high-altitude storms. So if there is a problem with those sensors, if they do ice up, what does that do to the plane?
If the pilots didn't recognize it and the airplane was getting bad airspeed signals, the autopilot on the airplane could have been trying to compensate for bad airspeed data. So, for example, if the airspeed was reading lower than the actual speed of the airplane, the throttles on this airplane, the engine controls, would automatically speed up. That could have actually driven the airplane into going too fast above its safe operating speed.
So when folks are sitting, when you're on an airplane and you can see that sort of screen and it shows
sure.
you potentially
yep.
where
yep.
you're flying,
yeah.
Some of us may have been under the impression that what we're seeing on that screen is exactly what air traffic controllers are seeing when they track the plane. But if you're in the middle of the ocean, that's not the case, is it?
Normally the way air traffic control over land masses works is that you have a radar. And the radar sends out an electromagnetic wave. It bounces off the airplane and comes back to you. Once you're out over the ocean, there's no radar that can see that far. So you're now reliant on the airplane to tell you where it is. And the normal procedure over the oceans is for the pilots to report in every 600 miles or so. We're now starting to implement automatic reporting in certain parts of the world. So in the Pacific and in the North Atlantic, the airplanes will automatically report their position. So the GPS sensor on the airplane sends a message out to the air traffic control facility. In the South Atlantic, they don't do that yet. So that's one of the reasons why the airplane wasn't being surveilled or nobody was looking at it directly when it went down.
What do you think is the future when it comes to tracking aircraft?
Well, actually, most of the world now is switching to a new type of surveillance or tracking system called automatic dependent surveillance. What that is the navigation systems on board the aircraft, GPS, for example, knows where the airplane is, so it broadcasts in the blind the location of the airplane. So that can be picked up both by the air traffic control facilities, but it can also be picked up by other airplanes in the area. So what it allows you to do is sort of do air traffic control in a slightly different way. That system is actually being implemented in the U.S. now. It's operational in Australia, and it's being used in northern Canada over the Hudson Bay. Over the ocean, the system that we're shifting to is a satellite version of this, where airplanes send their messages back to air traffic control through a satellite, again, at periodic intervals, every 5 minutes or something like that.
Do you think that either of those things might have helped in this particular case of the crash of this Air France jet?
It would have helped in the sense that we would have had better position reporting, so they would have known where to look more quickly. I don't think it would have done a lot in terms of telling us more than we know now about what happened.
What's the most surprising thing about this to you, about this crash?
One of the surprising things is it happened in cruise phase of flight, the safest part of any flight. If you look historically at all the accidents, we spend most of our time in cruise, but only about 6% of the accidents occur there. So that was surprising. Apparently a perfectly good airplane flown by a very qualified crew on a relatively routine flight goes missing. That's the surprising thing.
Well, John Hansman, professor of aeronautics and astronautics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and a pilot, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
And in related news, the National Transportation Safety Board begins hearings tomorrow on the forced landing of U.S. Airways Flight 1549 into the Hudson River between New York and New Jersey in January. After the landing, flight attendant Doreen Welsh testified before Congress that a passenger pushed past her and opened a rear door on the aircraft, sending water rushing into the cabin. But some passengers have told federal investigators that it was Welsh and not a panicked passenger who opened that door. Passengers also described a harrowing scene where people struggled to move forward to safety as the water rose. The Association of Flight Attendants said Welsh is unavailable for comment. Also, the International Air Transport Association, which represents 230 airlines, predicts that airline companies will collectively lose $9 billion this year. Fewer people are traveling and cargo demand is shrinking. The hardest hit region, says the association, is Asia. And before we go today, Jack Kerouac's fantasy baseball team. You're listening to Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org.
Welcome back to Here and Now. Jack Kerouac is well known as the voice of the so-called Beat Generation, but before his well-known novel, On the Road, Kerouac was honing his literary skills, writing stories about imaginary baseball players and an unbeatable horse that he called Repulsion. Repulsion was just one of the characters in an intricate world of fantasy sport games that Kerouac created and played. This other side of Kerouac is the subject of a new book called Kerouac at Bat, Fantasy Sports and the King of the Beats. The author is Isaac Gewurz. He's curator of the New York Public Library's Henry W. and Albert A. Berg Collection of English and American Literature, and he joins us from his office. And Isaac, first of all, how would you describe this? Was this a hobby for Kerouac?
I think it's more than a hobby. I think it almost borders on obsession, although that word might not be completely appropriate because it seems to exclude an element of joy, and there certainly was that in it for Kerouac, both as a young man and later as an adult. The big thing to remember about these materials is there was the playing of the games, and then there was the recording that he wrote by hand, what happened in them, and the creation of fictional identities for the horses as well, for the trainers and jockeys, for the owners, and then in baseball for all of the players, the managers, the coaches, and the owners. It was an all-consuming passion of his, I would say.
Hmm. Well, let's talk about the games a little more specifically. The horse racing game was first. Let's talk about that.
The horse racing was done by putting a row of marbles and one ball bearing behind a toothpick on a Parcheesi board and raising the toothpick and letting them roll down the Parcheesi board. It was a rather simple game in distinction to the baseball. The writing about it, though, was where he really allowed his creativity to flourish.
And in the horse racing case, he calls his horse Repulsion. And he says, Repulsion because I knew he would repulse all other horses forever, which he did.
That's correct. And, of course, the ball bearing had greater mass, so it was inevitable that it would beat all of the other marbles.
Right. Kerouac also used marbles to play the baseball game. He would hit them with a nail, and he produced these elaborate cards describing what would happen on each pitch. He named his teams after cars of the day, the St. Louis LaSalles, the Chicago Nashes, and you can see some examples at our website. But Isaac, can you help us understand where this fantasy world came from? We know that Kerouac loved sports. He was a good athlete himself. But was that why he was so passionate about these fantasy games?
I think it had a strong influence, but for the most part, it was a wonderful, engaging way to escape the conflicts, the pain of the real world. The family in which he was born had tensions within it between the mother and father, and certainly between Jack Kerouac himself and his parents, as he grew into adolescence. And with the death of his brother, which traumatized him, the expectations that normally fall on the elder brother fell on him. So that was not a burden that he always carried well or willingly.
Mm-hmm. His brother, Gerard, died. Gerard was 9 and Kerouac was 4. And he struggled with that, and he actually wrote about it at one point.
He wrote a visionary novel about his brother called Visions of Gerard.
Let's listen here to an actor reading from the Kerouac book, Visions of Gerard. This is from a documentary called Jack Kerouac, King of the Beats.
Then comes the solemn funeral. I was taken back on a rainy, dreary day to see the house, all one great gloom shrine, full of kids from the San Luis parochial school filing in and out. in frightened parades, their eyes straining to see the dead face in the unholy velvet pillow among the flowers. The sooner they see it, the quicker they'll know the face of death and fears be justified all. And files of nuns standing by the coffin praying with long black wooden rosaries.
There was a great resentment that Kerouac felt toward his brother because he had slapped him. And after his brother's death, he felt a certain guilt over that because the two events were not too far apart, apparently. And that, in turn, led to conflicts about feeling resentment, yet his sainted brother is being eulogized and mythologized by the family and friends. And how does one deal with that? Hmm. So that was a source of great tension in his life and in his consciousness, really. So in the end, I wouldn't want to reduce his writing to his trauma or reduce the game just to the trauma, but there's some kind of a mixture there.
So in the end, Isaac, what do you think that it means? What do you think this whole fantasy world that Jack Kerouac created, what does that tell us about him?
First, it shows us his great obsession with statistics. I think it shows also a great need to escape, although that's not unique to Kerouac. We all do that with whatever form of entertainment we choose for ourselves. With Kerouac, I think it was carried to a much higher degree. And it's an outlet for the talents of a budding young writer. There are many vivid, interesting phrases that break through there. He refers to a hot grounder that is hit to the third baseman as leaving the third baseman in a shambled heap, which is, I think, a great description. Mm-hmm. And there are others like that. So you see the writer coming out. And as a young boy, and even as a young man to some extent, for a while there, and senior in high school when he was in Horace Mann, he was thinking of becoming a sports writer. So you see that, the kind of the apprentice sports writer honing his craft, too. So all of that is interesting giving us another insight into his character, his ambition, his talent.
Mm-hmm. Isaac Gewirtz is author of Kerouac at Bat, Fantasy Sports, and The King of the Beats. For more, go to our website, hereandnow.org. Isaac, thank you.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.
And sense all that raw land that rolls in one unbelievable huge bulge over to the west coast.
And before we go today, let's listen to a clip of Jack Kerouac reading from his book, On the Road, while Steve Allen plays the piano. This is from Allen's show in 1959.
And tonight the stars will be out. And don't you know that God is Pooh Bear? The evening star must be drooping and shedding her sparkler dims on the prairie, which is just before the coming of complete night that blesses the earth, darkens all the rivers, cups the peaks, and folds the final shore in. Nobody knows what's going to happen to anybody besides the forlorn rags of growing old. Think of Dean Moriarty, or even think of old Dean Moriarty, the father we never found. Think of Dean Moriarty. I think of Dean Moriarty.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Deborah Becker. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.